Bonjour, je suis ravi d'accueillir Eric Dietz à la série de séminaires de mon cours. Et ce n'est pas un hasard que Eric ouvre la série, parce qu'il apporte une approche originale et unique pour considérer la cellule comme un système pour le traitement de l'information. Son approche est à la fois grande, vaste et profonde. Il est basé sur les données, mais aussi il est conceptuel, il est pragmatique, mais en même temps, Eric est désireux d'aller au-delà de la simple description, mais cherchant à comprendre ce que la cellule pourrait réellement faire. Et ça, telle compréhension nécessite une approche théorique, un effort théorique. Et cela est évident dans la route scientifique d'Eric. Après avoir obtenu son diplôme de premier cycle à la Case Western Reserve University à Cleveland, dans l'Ohio, il a obtenu son doctorat à Harvard sous la direction de Eugene Shaknovich et a rédigé plusieurs articles très importants qui connectent l'évolution dans le contexte, qui traitent l'évolution dans le contexte biophysique du pliage des protéines et des interactions entre les protéines. J'ai eu la chance de le recruter dans mon groupe comme postdoc en 2007. Et au cours de sa période postdoctorale, Eric a collaboré étroitement avec un collègue, Tom Kolokotronis, afin de résoudre un débat vieux de 80 ans dans la biologie qui concerne une loi d'échelle métabolique, une loi qui décrit la relation entre le taux métabolique et la masse corporelle au niveau des espèces. Parallèlement à ses travaux, c'est important, il a fusionné sa connaissance des interactions entre les protéines avec son intérêt au système dynamique. Et il a construit le premier modèle kappa à grande échelle, avec lequel il a étudié les interactions entre l'assemblage des complexes de protéines dans l'entière cytoplasme de la levure. Et son modèle a seulement considéré les liaisons et les dissociations sans règlement, entier. Et de ce point de vue, ce modèle pourrait être considéré complètement ridicule. Mais en même temps, il est profond parce qu'en omettant la régulation, il a souligné les types de problèmes qu'on évite ou que la cellule évite si on a la régulation. C'est un peu comme modéliser un orchestre symphonique qui joue sans une partition, même si sans savoir quelle partition il faut jouer. Alors, on comprend ce que exactement la partition fait. Et au milieu, après ces travaux, au milieu de la grande récession, quand le monde semblait s'écraser, il est allé à l'Université de Kansas, où il a continué de faire des travaux très intéressants sur les réseaux des interactions entre les protéines et l'évolution. Il est retourné un peu vers son intérêt évolutif. Et c'était clair qu'il y aura des intérêts des autres universités à recruter Eric. Et en fait, UCLA, University of California at Los Angeles, l'a recruté il y a un an, et où Eric est maintenant en train d'établir un groupe de recherche. Il a une passion pour l'enseignement, comme vous pourrez constater tout de suite. Et je suis très, très ravi d'accueillir Eric.
Merci. Bonjour. I'm going to give this in English, so I hope that's okay, because I don't know French that well, so hopefully that will work out. So I want to thank Walter in particular for inviting me. Obviously, as he just told you, I had the privilege of being a part of Walter's group at Harvard Medical School in the Department of Systems Biology. And what I'm going to tell you about today, I think, reflects a lot of what I learned from Walter in terms of how to think about certain types of theoretical questions in biology, and also just the exposure to the intellectual milieu that Walter had in his group. And the title of the talk mirrors a book that was the first book Walter ever gave me, which is called The Evolution of Individuality by Leo Buss. If you haven't read it, it's a fantastic book. Some of the ideas that are in that book also contributed to what I'm going to be talking about today. So hopefully I'll be able to get through most of what I have. I have an ambitious program here, so the final introductory word I will say is it's also an honor to be starting out Walter's seminar as part of his course. And I hope you enjoy enjoy it. For those of you who have been attending Walter's course, I had the privilege also to come to one of the lectures this week on Tuesday, and it was in French, but my French is sufficiently okay that I was able to follow at least part of it. Walter has been talking about how information is transferred between generations of cells. So I'm just going to give one type of example of this, and then I'm going to use this example to introduce another notion of information that's important for thinking about cellular life. So this is a yeast cell. It's obviously not a real one. This is a cartoon. But the idea is that yeast exists for a variety of purposes. But one of the main things they want to do is make more yeast, right? So this is a budding yeast cell. This is a mother cell. This is its daughter. And it's going to keep budding and producing more and more yeast so that it can take over its local environment and propagate its genome. And this is the transmission of genetic information, essentially the replication of the genome of this cell. If it's dividing in a haploid way, produces many copies. And so the genetic information that was present in the mother is passed on to the daughter cells. But there's another important aspect of information here, and that depends on the environment. So let's say we find a yeast cell in an environment that has a lot of sugar. In nature, this might be a situation where we have grapes growing, we have some grape juice. So what these yeast will do is ferment that sugar, ferment the fructose or glucose or whatever sugar source they have, and doing so, they produce alcohol, which is fantastic, right? So we love this. I love it. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I love it too much. Whatever. Produces alcohol for us. And the reason that yeast do this, we could talk about. One of the reasons is that it's very fast. And is essentially, when you perform this kind of fermentation process, you invest less energy in the proteins and the metabolic apparatus that allow you to extract energy from substrate, in particular the sugar. And a byproduct of that is alcohol, which also helps the yeast cells, because most microbes that you encounter on a grape, the surface of a grape, or in the world, aren't that tolerant to alcohol. But yeast is. So it can live at much higher concentrations of alcohol than most organisms. But at some point, it's going to run out of that sugar. There isn't an infinite amount of sugar in this grape juice. So what will it do then? Well, it still wants to replicate and transmit that genetic information. But what it will actually do is shift from metabolizing the sugar to metabolizing the alcohol that it itself fermented and created. And if you do that long enough, you will get some pretty terrible tasting water. So this is the opposite. It turns wine into water, the opposite of what you may have heard. So So this is an example of how environmental information is critical to the life of unicellular organisms. So unicellular organisms need to know what nutrients are present so they don't waste energy making proteins that are useless. So for instance, there are different proteins that metabolize sugar than metabolize alcohol. And we don't want to make the sugar metabolizing proteins if we don't have any sugar present. If we're living in a world that has mostly alcohol as a carbon substrate, we'd like to shift our metabolic processes entirely focus on that. And that's going to allow us to produce copies of ourselves more quickly if we're little yeast cells. This is just one example that I hope connects with some things you may know, but there are many, many other examples of this kind of information being critical for unicellular organisms. Stressors like increased temperature or increased concentration of solutes are another thing that unicellular organisms need to sense in order to respond adaptively to their environment and optimize their fitness. If we think about multicellular organisms, the problem of information from the environment's a little different, because most of our cells don't actually interact directly with the outside world. Instead, they interact with other cells. And to give you a picture of what that looks like, this is what's called a bone remodeling compartment. And what it represents is the dynamic process whereby all of our bones are replaced over time. So in the next 10 years, all of the bones that you currently have will be entirely replaced. And you may not know that, but that's how it actually works. And that's important because bones are not rocks. They're actually living material. They contain hydroxyapatite, a calcium-based mineral substrate, but they also contain these cells, which form a network within the bone.
and a variety of other living components that are important to refresh over time. So the way that this works is there are two types of cells, osteoblasts and osteoclasts. The osteoclasts, they look pretty terrible here. They're like these octopus cells. They're huge. They eat the bone, so they basically secrete proteases and acid. They basically dissolve the bone and resorb it. So they recycle those materials for the osteoblasts, who then use those materials to build more bone, okay? And this is constantly happening. But one of the problems we have is that osteoclasts and osteoblasts don't live forever. They're terminally differentiated cells, and they only last about a month. So there are precursor cells, stem cells, if you will. The precursor cells for osteoclasts are actually immune cells. And there are mesenchymal cells that give rise to osteoblasts. And you could imagine that the rate at which we make osteoclasts and the rate at which we make osteoblasts actually kind of determines the net production or resorption of bone, right? So if I have way more osteoclasts than osteoblasts, I'm going to eat my bone. And that's bad because I need my bones to stand up, right? So we want to maintain this balance. We also have to make this system responsive to actual environmental changes. So for instance, when you break a bone, that's sensed by these osteocytes. Then those osteocytes somehow tell these cells what to do. And in particular, what they have to do is reduce the production of osteoclasts. So essentially, they induce the osteoclast to undergo what's called apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. So the number of osteoclasts goes down, and the number of osteoblasts goes up, so that you can then repair that damage to the bone. So this system not only has to maintain homeostasis, it also has to react to things like a break. And all of that, all of those processes are orchestrated by a communication network among the cells. So these cells are talking to each other, and they're self-regulating and self-organizing their own behavior. They sense, there are cells that have a job to sense things like a break, and then they secrete factors, growth factors, cytokines, and a variety of other soluble molecules, which are then detected by different cells and reacted to in the appropriate way. So if we zoom in on one of these cells, one of the things my lab is really interested in working on is understanding how are the molecular details and the molecular organization of proteins within these cells, how have they evolved to allow a system like this to perform that kind of very complicated function. So if we look inside that cell, this is what's going on. And I've been talking about information in a kind of abstract way. The idea is that there's information, regardless of whether you're talking about yeast or an osteoblast or an osteoblast precursor in the bone. There's information on the outside, and the cells need to know about it in order to do the right thing. But there's a bit of a problem, and that is that all cells have a barrier between themselves and the outside world. That's why we call them cells. They have either a cell membrane or a wall or something like that that keeps the stuff inside the cell inside. And these molecules that these cells are trying to detect, generally, not always, but generally don't diffuse through the cell membrane. So this causes a problem because I'm a cell. I don't have eyes. I don't have ears. I don't have a mouth. But I want to know what's going on, right? I want to see these changes in nutrients or these changes in cell-cell communication factors. So the way this problem is solved in general is that there's a special protein, which is called a receptor, that is an integral membrane protein. So that means it lives in the membrane. That's where it's supposed to be. And it kind of spans this divide between the outside and the inside. And then the information, whatever I'm interested in, so if that's a sugar molecule, it might bind to this receptor. Sugar actually gets imported, but the idea is the same. If it's a cytokine, it will bind to a receptor or a growth factor, will bind to a cognate receptor. That will cause a conformational change in that protein. Basically, the information gets transported through this barrier. And then there's a protein interaction network that transduces that binding event to whatever has to happen next. And by and large, though not always, by and large, this involves changes in gene expression. So in the case of the yeast, when you detect glucose, what you're going to do is change the expression of proteins so that you both import and metabolize glucose in an optimal way. Similarly for alcohol or for a variety of sugar and carbon, carbon and nitrogen substrates. Cells like the osteoblasts and the osteoclasts, our cells, what's going to happen here is that you're going to get either changes in gene expression or gross changes in behavior, like differentiation or undergoing apoptosis. And so regardless of the context, there's this protein interaction network that mediates that transmission of information from the surface of the cell to the DNA, where a lot of these changes end up being implemented. And it turns out that there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening in that divide, in that space between the reception event, where the information is kind of detected, and the changes in gene expression. And I'm going to walk you through some work that we've done in my lab over the past several years to try to understand two issues that that one faces when one is trying to sort of rationalize or understand how these processes work inside of our cells in particular, metazoan cells, human cells. And the two things I'm going to talk about in a little bit of detail are something that's called crosstalk and something that I'm going to summarize as heterogeneity. Sometimes it's also referred to as noise. And I'm going to go through both of these ideas and try to give you an impression of why these problems complicate our interpretation of cell signaling and the work that we've done to try to figure out the evolutionary pressures that might have given rise to both large amounts of crosstalk and large amounts of heterogeneity. So let's focus on crosstalk first. Let's start talking about that. So this is a tiny picture, a tiny piece of the protein interaction network that mediates the transmission of information in human cells. So all of these blue dots are cell surface receptors. Those are the things that live in the cell membrane that are going to interact with the outside world. And all of these red dots, all of these red circles, are the transcription factors that are going to actually mediate those changes in gene expression that are important for the cell responding appropriately to changes in its environment. And in the middle here, we have that protein interaction network. These are other proteins. Each one of these black circles is some other protein that isn't a receptor or a transcription factor, but rather mediates that transmission of information. And this happens through the formation of protein complexes. I'm not going to go into the mechanistic details of how this works. But the basic idea is that these proteins, there are many copies of each of them in the cell. They're diffusing around in the cell cytoplasm. They bind to one another, and there are processes that allow information to be transferred from here to here. That's all well and good, but when you look at this, you can immediately see that this is very complicated. So if I tell you that I'm tickling this receptor here, and I'm binding that with something, and I ask you, what's going to happen? How is this system going to respond? That becomes a very difficult question to answer. And in fact, the way that most cell biologists who study cell signaling solve some of the problem of the complexity is to develop what are known as cell signaling pathways, which focus on a restricted subset of the proteins that might be downstream of one receptor or a few receptors that they care to study experimentally, and then work on that to try to rationalize what's happening. But when we take a global view and integrate all of the information that we have available to us on the kinds of protein interactions that are mediating this information transmission, we see this huge amount of complexity. So that's a problem, and I hope I've convinced you that it's kind of difficult to tell yourself a story about how this thing works. It turns out that that's not the only paradigm we have for cell signaling in the world. So I forgot to mention that in building this diagram, we took six of those signaling pathways from a database called KEG, the Kyoto Encyclopedia of Genes and Genomes. And this is a tiny fraction of the protein interaction network that actually mediates cell signaling in human cells, but it's just an illustration. When you go to that same website, you can click through to a different set of organisms, bacteria. And you can say, okay, for single-celled organisms like bacteria, how does their cell signaling look? And you can see it's much simpler, right? Here, I can hardly tell what's going to happen when I turn this protein on. But when I turn one of these guys on, I can immediately say, oh, here's a receptor. It's binding. It's going to interact directly with a transcription factor. And usually, these are activating interactions. So it turns on the transcription factor when it binds whatever molecule in the environment it's meant to detect. So I turn this on, and boom, I get this. So instead of having all of this mess in the middle, I've got these nice isolated pathways that are both very simple and very straightforward. It's very easy to understand what's going on here. So one of the things we've been working on for quite some time in my group is to try to understand why these topologies are so different. And because of time, I'm not going to go into all of the work that we've done on this problem, but I'm going to focus mainly on the question of why there's so much crosstalk in between cell surface receptors and transcription factors in the signaling networks in humans. There are biochemical reasons that we've discovered that we think prevent bacteria from evolving these complicated networks, sort of biochemical constraints that they have to deal with, that have to do with the actual like molecular details of these interactions and the specific mechanisms that are used there. But I'm not going to go into that in any detail. So suffice to say that we've shown that there's a constraint that prevents bacteria from having crosstalk. And we don't have that constraint. We can have as much crosstalk as we want at the biochemical level. But the problem is that just because you can have something doesn't mean that you should. Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know, the bread here in Paris is amazing. I love it. It's astonishing. Croissant? We can't get these croissants in LA, I will tell you that. So, but just because I can have them doesn't mean that I should have an arbitrary number of them, right? I shouldn't just keep eating them all the time because then I will die before I get back to LA. Or at least become very, very fat. So I don't need that many croissants. So just the same idea here is that just because these cell signaling networks can have this high amount of crosstalk from a biochemical standpoint doesn't mean that they should have so much, right? So to kind of try to reason about that, we did an interesting, or what I thought was an interesting thought experiment. So let's think about cell signaling in a human context, a multicellular context. We've got an environment that's experienced by two different populations of cells. Population A and B. These might be our osteoblast precursors and our osteoclast precursors. And that same environment has to be transduced into two different responses, right? So if I break my bone, for instance, and I'll go over this in just a second, I'm going to want to proliferate my osteoclast or osteoblast precursors because I want to make more bone, and the osteoblasts make more bone. So I'm going to want to have these guys proliferate. At the same time, I don't want to be making osteoclasts because they're going to eat the bone that I'm trying to lay down to repair that break. So I want these guys to undergo apoptosis, right? So I have the same environment, the same exact perturbation, the same broken bone, but two very different responses. So just to come back to this picture, the idea is I make a break, and that break is going to result, it's a single environment, and there's going to be a single milieu of different factors present, and soluble factors that are present in this environment that are going to control these behaviors. But although they're experiencing the same environment, the osteoclast precursors and the osteoblast precursors have to do something very, very different. So how might I implement that in a world where I have absolutely no crosstalk? This is a world where individual receptors control one transcription factor and no others. What I would have to do is develop kind of a control structure, a control strategy that would allow me to tell the first cell type, like the osteoblast precursors, what to do. So I would have a signal that I would give these guys when I want them to divide. That would be this one. I'd have a single signal that I'd give them when I want them to divide, when I want them or divide to undergo apoptosis, to differentiate. There's a variety of things they can do, and I'll have a signal to tell them to do each one of them. But then the problem is now here I have cell type 2, right? And I can have absolutely no crosstalk, but I want to be able to tell cell type 1 to divide and cell type 2 to die. So I'm going to have a different set of receptors and transcription factors for cell type 2 so that I can control its behavior independently. And if I have 10 or 100 or 1,000 different cell types in the same environment, if you think about the human brain, at this level of description, there are at least hundreds of cell types that might be present in roughly the same environment that would need to be controlled separately. This is a problem because now I'm going to have separate signaling channels for each of my cell types, right? So if I have no crosstalk, I'm going to have to devise a set of channels for each cell type that I want to control. And that's a problem for a variety of reasons. For one, this requires a lot of distinct signaling molecules, lots of different receptors and lots of different transcription factors. And it's not clear that biophysically you could evolve that many cytokines and that many receptors that all interact with perfect specificity, or at least sufficient specificity. Also, you can imagine in this paradigm, evolving a new cell type is going to be pretty difficult. Because in order to evolve a new cell type, which is truly independently controlled, I have to evolve a whole set of new channels that tell that cell type what to do in any given situation. So evolving a new cell type in this paradigm could be relatively difficult. So how do we solve this problem? Well, the primary idea, and this is not an idea that we really came up with, but I'll show you in just a second that it's an idea that we were able to explore, at least in a little more detail, perhaps. The alternative approach to controlling different cell types and allowing them to respond differently to the same environment is the following. So we have these inputs, and we have these outputs, And we have this like really unholy mess in between the two of them, right? But in cell type 1, we express a different set of proteins. So this is a well-known feature of different cell types in the body. Different cell, if you take the osteoclast and you take the osteoblast and you compare them, you could ask, okay, which proteins do osteoclasts have and which ones do osteoblasts have? They have very different protein repertoires. They express different proteins. And from a cell signaling context, that means that there are certain holes in this network. There might be certain proteins that are absent. I'm going to be dealing this primarily intellectually from a presence-absence standpoint. You'll see why in a moment. But you could imagine, actually, that there are different concentrations or different relative amounts of each of these proteins in this particular cell type. And then for cell type 2, I've got a different expression pattern. And for cell type N, I've got a different expression pattern. And the idea is that the net effect of all of those differences is to allow cell type 1 and cell type 2 to experience the same exact set of inputs. Rather than each of them listening to different channels, they all listen to the same music, but they dance in different ways. In other words, they respond to the same exact set of inputs by expressing very different transcription factors or activating very different transcription factors and thereby responding very differently. So the idea is that in this sort of classic, I'm not going to go into this in great detail. Walter may talk about this later in his course, I don't know. The idea that in a multicellular organism, you've got some process of cell differentiation that might be represented by a stem cell rolling down a landscape and then ending up in different stable states of differentiated cells. This is actually called Waddington's epigenetic landscape. And the idea is that each of these cells have the same genome, but they express very different phenotypes. And they do that because they express very different proteins. And the idea here is that part of that differential expression of proteins has to do with impacting the response of these cell signaling networks. So here you've got one, and here you've got a different subnetwork of the whole thing. And that results in different responses to the same environment. So in order to explore this in more detail, what we did was actually try to see, is there any sort of signature or indication that this might really be happening in our cell signaling network in humans? So we tried at the time to build a large representation of the entire signaling network in human cells. So rather than focusing on individual pathways, we took 29 different pathways in this Kyoto Encyclopedia of Genes and Genome database and combined them into a single network. And I don't know how many of the people in the audience have ever been to this thing, but basically you can click on different pathways that have different names, like EGF signaling pathway or insulin signaling pathway or what have you. When you do that, you find that they often, it gives you a picture. It gives you a basically a graphical description of the protein interactions that occur in that particular subpart of the network. But the interesting thing is that they often involve the same exact proteins. So if you click on epidermal growth factor, EGF signaling, you'll see that it involves a particular MAP kinase called ERK. Doesn't matter what it is, it's a protein that's important. Okay? And then if you click on the insulin signaling or IGF signaling networks, you'll find that same protein is there. So that provides a very natural way to be able to stitch these things together, which is what we did. This gives us a pretty large perspective on cell signaling. So we've got 735 proteins. This is only 6 of the 29. So the real thing is so large that it isn't that we couldn't draw this, we just didn't have the patience to format it so that you could look at it in any way that looks reasonable. But the whole thing is huge, and anyway, it's just a hairball, so you can't really see what's going on. There's 735 proteins, you've got 76 receptors at the cell surface, 67 transcription factors. So essentially 10% of these proteins are either on the surface or another 10% represent the transcription factors. And what we first asked is how much crosstalk is there in this network? And what I can tell you is in this network that we built, which represented at the time, this is some years ago now, the best guess that humans have regarding what cell signaling looks like in our cells, every single transcription factor is downstream of every receptor. What that means is that there's a path I can walk through in the network that follows these edges in a directed way, meaning that this thing activates or represses this thing, which then activates or represses this thing. I can walk from every blue thing to every red thing, which means theoretically at least that every single receptor in that network will impact the activity of every single transcription factor, which I think underlies the idea that while we think about these things sometimes as pathways, an integrated network perspective is actually the one that one has to take in order to understand the global dynamics of this kind of thing. And actually, in this network, 78% of the nodes are downstream of every receptor. So a receptor, if you turn it on, it's going to have, at least theoretically, the ability to impact 78% of everything in the network. So rather than sort of being organized as a set of modular, discrete pathways, this thing is kind of organized as a very, very integrated, composed, and complicated network. We then wanted to say, okay, now that we have this picture of cell signaling or this map of the protein interaction dynamics or protein interactions present in this part of the human signaling network, how are we going to build those sort of cell-specific networks where you've got one set of proteins expressed in one cell and a different set expressed in a different cell? And at the time, the best data that we could find for that came from something called the Human Protein Atlas, which in 84 distinct tissues, so it's not quite cell type level specificity, but it's not too bad. Essentially what they do is they do a kind of experiment called immunohistochemistry. They take a slice of the tissue and they use an antibody to try to find the proteins, and they had antibodies for about half of the proteins in this network. So they were able to get a pretty good coverage of what we were looking at. And they were just saying, okay, you know, how much of the protein does there happen to be in this particular tissue slice? And they had four different levels, but for us, all we did was say, if a protein is not detected, meaning the antibody can't find it at all, you get no staining, then we don't include it in the network. Otherwise, it's there because it's present. So we can sort of norm this data into presence-absence. So and it's not a bad, I think, approximation to say that if in this kind of experiment you can't see any staining at all, you've got very little of that protein, if any at all. So that's what we did to kind of make cell type, or at least tissue type specific networks. So then what we asked is, how are these networks different from the one that we started with? Because the idea is that they should be at least somewhat different, right? If our hypothesis about how this thing works is correct. And what I'm showing you here is a probability distribution over all of the tissues that we looked at. The number of outputs reached by each individual receptor. So you go to a receptor in a certain tissue, and you say, okay, how many transcription factors do you impact? How many of them could you change if you were activated? And remember, for the network that we started with, it was all 67 of them. So every single transcription factor can respond to every single receptor. But that was actually never true for any of the tissues that we looked at. So it turns out that sort of ultra connectivity is actually never observed, at least in practice, at least in this particular kind of view of the data. So if you go into each of these tissues, they have pretty high connectivity, but they never have that complete connectivity that we observe for the whole thing. Interestingly, what we found is that the connectivity of these subnetworks that we find in each tissue is highly non-random. So one thing that you could do is take your liver cells. Say your liver cells express 75% of the proteins in your cell signaling network. So 75% of them are there, 25% of them are not. And now what we can do is we could make a random copy of that, right? By expressing 75% of the proteins, not based on the data, but just completely at random. So you go through, each protein has a 75% chance of being included and a 25% chance of being kicked out, right? So that is a way to make sort of a random version of the network. So these are different levels of gene expression. So from 100% of the proteins are there to none of them are there. So this is the fraction of genes that we retain. And this is the y-axis here is the average number of transcription factors that can respond to any given receptor. So this is basically, if I turn a receptor on average, how many outputs is it going to influence? And what we can see here in this curve, this red curve is the random controls, and it drops precipitously. So when you have all of the nodes present, then you can affect all 67, but rapidly you go from affecting them all to affecting very, very few of them. And we can see here that this is all of the 84 tissues that we got from the Human Protein Atlas, and you can see that they're much higher than you would expect at random. So while none of them have that completely connected property, they're more connected than you would expect at random. And this is one way of looking at non-randomness. There's a number of other ways in which these gene expression patterns seem to be non-random, but this is perhaps the most striking. So then we wanted to understand, how does this difference impact that input-output relationship that we were talking about? To what extent does changing that gene expression pattern impact the way that the cell type, or the tissue in this case, is going to respond to an environment? So what we did was a simulation approach called Boolean network simulations. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. But the basic idea is that in this particular kind of simulation, you represent the state of every protein in the network with a 1 or a 0. It's either on or off. And we might activate this receptor. And in the simulation, what's going to happen is that this receptor activates this protein. So at the next time step, what's going to happen is that we're going to turn that protein on. And you can see the overall consequence through the network of this change up here is that this 1 is going to propagate down to a change in activation of that receptor. We also have inhibiting interactions in this particular data. So we can turn this receptor on. And what's going to happen is that because this will, say, now turn because it's an inhibitor, if it turns this protein off, then that's going to propagate and turn that transcription factor off. What we did in this case, there's actually no data available in a sort of machine-readable, easy-to-implement form that allows you to say how these two conflicting interactions are going to sort of sum up here or integrate to the activity of this node. So here you have this one's on, and it wants to turn this guy on. Here you have this one's on, and it wants to turn it off. How do they resolve that conflict? How do they say, OK, well, what am I going to do? You want me to be on. You want me to be off. What am I supposed to do? We had to make a simplifying assumption in order to build what are called the Boolean logic functions. And we ran a very sort of simple simulation. But the idea was to just get an overall rather coarse-grained view of the kinds of differences in dynamics that you might observe in these different cell signaling networks. So I should stress that this is not meant to be a real, very, very accurate model of what's happening inside the cells, but is rather just meant to be a picture of how the differences in gene expression might impact differences in responses. And what we did was we did a very simple computational experiment. We basically tried every single input alone. So basically, this is like taking your cell type and pipetting in the epidermal growth factor. That's going to be input 1. And I'm going to saturate it. I'm going to give it as much as it would ever respond to. And then I'm going to look after many, many steps of simulation. I'm going to average over thousands of steps of simulation and kind of get a kind of average picture of what's the activity of the transcription factors. And for this very, very simple example, if I turn this transcription factor on, you can see it's going to turn on this transcription. If I turn this receptor on, it's going to turn on this transcription factor. And if I turn this receptor on, nothing's going to happen. If I take this second tissue, the difference here is just that this particular node now is absent. So because that node is absent, nothing happens to the first case. But in the second case, now I've got expression of transcription factor 2, where I didn't have that in this tissue. So what I can do is essentially perform this experiment with the real networks that are tissue-specific or cell-type-specific in this case. And I can ask, OK, how different are they? And there's a wide variety of ways that you might compare these output matrices. What we did is simply count the number of differences. So count the number of cases in which the level of activity of the transcription factor differed between the two. And that gives us what we call this input-output matrix difference. And what we found actually is that these real evolved networks are very, very different from one another in this kind of numerical experiment. So what I'm plotting here is the input-output matrix distance. This is a probability density over all possible pairwise comparisons between tissues. This blue data is the real expression data. The absolute value here doesn't really mean a lot. But what we can do is then compare it to either random tissues or isolated pathways. So this is the kind of diversity we would expect if we had that sort of bacterial cell signaling scenario, where every single input only leads to one output and only sort of influences one transcription factor. So if you have completely isolated pathways, you can see you get much less diversity between different cell types. So they're not really able to express a lot of different responses to the same environment. But if you look at random expression patterns, you also find that although they have a lot of crosstalk, so they don't have isolated pathways, if you just randomly express proteins in these networks, and in this case we're expressing the same number of proteins, but just choosing them at random, what we find is, so we're making like a random liver and a random kidney and a random blah. What we find here is that when we do that many, many times, you can see there the diversity of responses is also much less than we would expect in the real data. So this sort of implies at least, and there's a lot of stuff we did here that I don't have time to go into, that there's been an evolutionary pressure both on in terms of the network architecture, but also in terms of the specific gene expression patterns of different cell types to allow them to respond very differently to the same inputs. So hopefully that gives you an idea of how this type of cellular individuality might actually be implemented. So different cell types are going to respond differently to the same environment. And that kind of gives us at least some idea that there's some chance that the complexity that we observe here might at least in part be due to the fact that there's this constraint on multicellular or on signaling, cell signaling and cell communication in a multicellular context. There might be other reasons that contribute here, but at least we've got something to stand on there. So now what I'm going to talk about is heterogeneity and explain how heterogeneity also impacts our understanding of cellular individuality and cell signaling. So what I'm showing you here is some data that was collected by a collaborator of ours, John Bachman, in Peter Sorger's lab at Harvard Med School. And what I'm going to explain what this data is, but I want to just draw your attention to is the scale. So what we're doing here is a very cool kind of experiment that's become more and more possible over the last 10 or 15, 20 years. And that is we're looking at the cell signaling properties of individual cells. So what we can do in this particular case is take cells from a cell culture or from an organism or what have you, and we have tools that allow us to essentially detect how much of a certain protein is either present in an individual cell or active in an individual cell. And this is measuring the activity of two proteins that are key for this cell death, apoptosis process. And the thing I want to draw your attention to is the fact that the scale of this graph or this particular plot is a log scale. So this is a log 10 and this is log 10. Let's just look at this one particular condition, and let's look at the activation state of this particular protein. You can see that it spans actually from about 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 4 and a half, right? So there's orders of magnitude difference between different cells in this population. And actually, every time I've seen an experiment where someone tries to measure a cell signaling property in individual metazoan cells, human cells, be they from cell culture or from real organisms, mice, what have you, it's almost always a log normal distribution, which means that it's not like height. So height in this room among people might vary by plus or minus 10 centimeters or something like that, right? It's not going to vary by times or divided by 10, a factor of 10, right? So it's not like we're going to have people who are 10 times smaller than I am and 10 times taller, right? So this is a very different kind of variation than we generally see in things like height. It's a log normal variation. And that means that isogenic cells, so these are cells that are the same cell type, that I just was telling you this story about how they're going to respond in a different, was making it seem like all the cells in that cell in that population want to respond the same way. These are the osteoblasts. They want to replicate. These are the osteoclasts, right? I'm trying to kill them, right? But here I can see that, wow, there's a lot of diversity in these osteoclasts. So does that impact their cell signaling responses? And that's the story I'm going to tell you about right now. Hopefully I'll have time to talk about it. So the issue that arises here is one of cellular confusion, okay? So I've got some signal in the environment, and I'm adding it at different concentrations. And the point of the cell signaling network that I've evolved is to detect that signal. And what we imagine is that it's supposed to have evolved to detect different levels of that signal. So it shouldn't just detect whether it's present or absent. It should be able to actually tell how much of it's there. And the problem is that what this represents is kind of a schematic sort of experiment in which I'm adding to my culture of cells different amounts of the signal. And then what I'm doing is I'm at some point later in time, I'm using microscopy or some other technology to measure the response of individual cells. So I have some average response represented by the dots, and then these standard deviations represent that heterogeneity. And here they're actually pretty small. In reality, you'll see that the standard deviations are often really, really large. So this is the molecular response in individual cells to different signals. And what I can do is I can then plot these two distributions at neighboring signal values or somewhat separated signal values. And there's a problem, because you can see these distributions overlap. right? So imagine that I go to one of these cells and I ask, how much signal were you treated with? There's a bit of a problem because cells in this overlapping region, they can't tell if they were treated with signal value A or signal value B. They're confused. And so that limits the extent to which cells can look at their own responses. Because remember, they can't actually, they can't smell or taste, and they can't measure, they don't have a device to measure the amount of signal there is. All they have is what's happening inside them. And in fact, the device to measure the amount of signal is the cell signaling network we're talking about, right? So this is all they have, right? So I'm a cell, I'm responding, I've got some amount of response, and I want to know, you know, I'm supposedly using this thing to detect the signal in the environment, but here I'm confused. And you hopefully can imagine why that's a bit of a problem. So the question then becomes, how do we quantify that confusion? And it turns out that the way to do that is to use tools from information theory. So I've been talking about information in a very colloquial way so far, and also kind of not really explaining what I mean by the cell-cell communication, right? At least not in the framework of information theory. But it turns out that you can use information theory to think about these problems. So in telecommunications processes, we have some sort of sender who's going to be trying to send a signal through some sort of channel, right? So in the case of all of our cell phones, there's some cell tower around here that is sending out signals, radio waves, that are being detected by our phones. And vice versa, our phones are sending signals back to the tower, right? So there's some sort of channel. And in this case, that channel is the radio waves going through the atmosphere. But of course, that channel is going to be subject to noise, things like atmospheric interference or something like that. And that's going to impact how things are transmitted from the channel. So for instance, if that interference is really, really, really bad, what you might have is a situation where I'm the cell tower, I'm trying to send like I Love Lucy on YouTube to my phone, but instead of receiving that on my phone, what I actually receive is just garbage, right? Because there's so much noise in the environment, there's so much interference, that I'm actually not receiving the message that the tower, the sender, intended to send. It turns out that the sort of noise properties of these channels drastically impact the engineering of the systems that we have that allow us to reliably receive the information that we're supposed to get. Obviously, I'm not a communications theorist. I'm not going to talk about that, but that's the basic idea. And the way to think about this in terms of cell communication is that the sender is other cells in general, right? So if I'm the osteocyte, I live in the bone, and I detect that there's been a break. So now I've got to broadcast a message to everybody. Bad stuff has happened. We just got broken. Ah! Right? Okay, so how do I do that? Well, the message, instead of being radio waves, right, is going to be a change in the concentration of some sort of molecule. So that's what I'm sending. I'm like, bah! And I send out inflammation factors that say that there's been damage, for instance. So those are going to flood the local environment of the cells there in that compartment. And then there's going to be a protein interaction network that I've been talking about that kind of acts as the channel to mediate how that sent message ultimately is transduced into the response of the cell, right? That's the idea here. And I don't know how many of the people in the audience know anything about information theory, but the critical quantity that we tend to calculate is something called the mutual information, which has this definition. We have our signal, we have our response, there's probabilities and logs. I'm not going to go into this in any detail right now because I don't have time. But the basic idea is what this quantifies is how much knowing the response decreases our uncertainty about the signal. Right? Because that's going to tell us the extent to which information is reliably being transmitted on the channel. The idea here is that imagine we have a very, very sort of fake dose response curve where I've got four different signals and two different responses. If I try these signals with equal probability, I send 0 a quarter of the time, 1 a quarter of the time, 2 and 3 a quarter of the time. And I have these deterministic responses here, if I plug all this stuff in, I get 1 bit of information. And that's actually not a coincidence. What you can see if I use the log base 2 here, which allows me to quantify this information in Shannons or bits, you can see there's two levels of response, either low or high. So there's a 0 or 1, one bit of information, right? It can be transferred here. But the problem with the mutual information is that it depends on how I do the experiment, right? So imagine that you're me and you're a terrible experimentalist. And you, instead of trying all of these signals, you just try 0 and 1. So you just hit 0 and 1 with equal probability, but you never try these two. What you can see here is that nothing happens. So regardless of whether I send a 0 or a 1 along this channel, I always get a 1 as my response. That's the only thing that occurs. So knowing the response reduces my uncertainty not at all, right? I have the same amount of uncertainty knowing the response as I did before I knew the response, right? So that means there's no mutual information. So I have zero information transmission. So that's a bit of a problem in the context of cell signaling, because in cell signaling, we actually never know what the distribution of input should be. So another useful quantity that was defined by Shannon himself when he was developing this theory originally is something called the channel capacity, which is the supremum over all of the input distributions that could possibly exist of the mutual information. So essentially, this is a little bit of a fiction, but you try every single input distribution. You try the first one, you try the second one, you try just hitting 0, just hitting 1, hitting 0 and 1 with equal probability, hitting 0, 1, and 2 with equal probability, blah, blah, blah. You try them all. There's an infinite number of them, but you try them all. And then you take the one that gives you the biggest mutual information. And that's the channel capacity. And another useful fiction to think about is that when you have some channel capacity C, 2 to that number is essentially the maximum number of distinguishable signals. So in this case, if it's got 1, that means it can distinguish 2 different signals, low and high. Make sense? Hopefully a little bit of sense. Okay, so it turns out that about almost 10 years ago now, Andrei Lovchenko's group, when he was at Johns Hopkins, did a really cool experiment, in which they used mutual information and the channel capacity to quantify the information theoretic properties of cell signaling in individual cells. So what they have is a cell culture here. They are treating these cells with a molecule called TNF, which is a molecule that causes inflammation. If you know anyone who takes or has rheumatoid arthritis, they might take an antibody drug that actually binds TNF. Because that's one treatment for rheumatoid arthritis. So this is a very important molecule involved in the kind of inflammatory cell signaling inside of our cells, or inside of our bodies, And so what they did here is they looked at the response of one transcription factor, in this case, NF-kappa-B, and at different levels of this, these are different concentrations of that input, different signal values, they can do a microscope experiment or a microscopy experiment to look at how much of that transcription factor gets active. Active NF-kappa-B goes to the nucleus, so we can quantify the amount of this NF-kappa-B in the nucleus and look at the distribution over cells in the population. And what you can immediately see here is that this is cells that are treated with no TNF at all. These are essentially resting cells. And these are cells that are treated with the maximum dose. Above this, nothing changes. The distribution doesn't change at all. So this is sort of the saturating dose of this molecule. And you can see that there's overlap between those distributions. There are some cells that have the same amount of NF-kappa-B activity at 0 as they would have at the maximum saturating amount. So when you plug this into a software that estimates mutual information, you get 0.92 bits. And actually, this group did this with a bunch of different data in the literature. And in almost every case, they found less than one bit of information. So the question becomes, I told this whole story about how cells evolve these beautiful networks to detect stuff in the environment. And it turns out that they're just awful at that job, right? Because if they had evolved to do this, they would be able to detect more than one bit of information, right? And people actually became really puzzled in the field regarding what this meant. There were some ideas that we integrate information over space and time. Some ideas that these values were low because we had the wrong notion of what the real response is. But one thing that's important to think about is that none of the cells in question here care at all about how much NF-kappa-B they have in their nucleus. They don't care at all. What they actually care about is the output phenotype. So what we decided to do was to look at this in the context of a cell signaling network where we could unambiguously score phenotypes. And that is this particular trail-based extrinsic apoptosis network. And I'm not going to go into the details here because I really am running out of time. As I said, it was ambitious. My apologies. But the idea is that there's some molecule input. It's called TRAIL. It's related to TNF. And it has this complicated network downstream of it. Not all of the details are shown here. There are two important proteins. This is the initiator caspase. This is the initiator caspase. It turns on the effector caspase, so it gets turned on sort of upstream in the network, sort of initially, fairly early on during signal transduction. This thing activates this arm of the signaling pathway and directly cleaves and activates this caspase, which is called the effector caspase. When this thing, the effector caspase, gets above a certain level of activity, the cell undergoes apoptosis and dies. And the cool thing is that this is a system where we have existing assays that can allow us to measure the molecular response of the activity of each of these proteins in individual cells. But also we can tell if a cell is dead or alive. And I'll just explain the experiment. So what we do is we add low levels of the signal and high levels of the signal. In individual cells, we quantify this initiator caspase and effector caspase activity. And we also quantify the survival rate, right? And this is the distribution of initiator caspase activity as a function of the input concentration. So you can see here that there's a bimodal response as the initiator caspase, or as the signal increases in concentration. You can ignore these cells, they're dead. So they're just there. When we do the calculation that I'm going to talk about, we ignore them, but I'm just showing you all of the data. If you look at these distributions, you see something that's very, again, you see this log scale on this axis. So these are log normal distributions of activity. And you can also see that there's quite a lot of overlap. So again, there's some overlap between the amount of activity that we get with no trail around and the amount of activity that we get with the saturating dose over here. And when we plug this into an estimator of the channel capacity, you get about 1 bit. It's a little less than 1 bit. So it's very similar to what people had seen previously. If you look at the effector caspase, which is the actual executioner of the cell, you can see that it's almost insensitive to the input concentration and carries very little information. But then, if you look at the percentage of cells that die in this population, the fraction of them that are alive as a function of TRAIL, instead of seeing these log normal distributions and all this craziness, what we actually find is that if you do two experiments on two different days with this amount of TRAIL, say 10 nanograms per milliliter, you find there's actually very little variation in the fraction that die. So what you see is that every time you do that experiment, around 90% of the cells survive, you know, plus or minus, 3 or 4%. But it's actually really very reliable. This depends on the number of cells you have. But you get a really nice response. And you can see here that over orders of magnitude of TRAIL concentration, you get this gradual decrease in the number of cells that survive. If we plug this into a channel capacity estimator, we get well over 3 bits. And the idea here is that perhaps part of the issue with thinking about the heterogeneity that we observe and the low amount of channel capacity is that what these cell signaling networks have actually evolved to do is not allow individual cells to detect their environment or changes in their environment, but rather to control the behavior of populations of cells. And it turns out that having noisy responses is actually a really, really good way to control the population level behavior of a system like this. The idea is that you have some signal that you're inputting, you have a threshold. There has to be a threshold in the system because you have a continuous signal that's being transformed into either alive or dead. There's no like 0.5 alive, right? You either are alive or you're dead. You've got a threshold, and that at each value of this signal, you can see here that there's some average response. And there's also a large standard deviation. And if you look at the fraction of that of this sort of population that's above this line, you can see that individual cells have no idea what response to have. But there's this nice smooth transition in terms of the number of cells that are going to be above that line. So if we look at this in terms of the percentage of cells that die as we change the signal, if we've got no noise at all in a simple signaling model like this, if cells are identical, then what you can see is I add some signal, add some more signal, and you go from having all alive to all dead, right? And you can immediately imagine why that would be a bad situation. Because if I break my bone, I would go from having, all my osteoclasts alive to all of them dead. And that could be very, very bad because it's not that I want to completely remove osteoclast activity. Rather, I want to go and perhaps reduce it by 20 or 30%. If I've got a noisy single-cell response, Instead of going from all alive to dead, I get a continuous transition. And the noisier the cells, the shallower that transition. So it's always continuous, regardless of the amount of noise in this simple model. But the cool thing is that as I add more noise, you can see this transition becomes more gradual. And that's just because it takes a longer range of signals to have all of, if you can imagine these error bars changing in width, to go from having all of them below to all of them above. That will happen over a wider range of signals, and you can see that this transition then becomes more gradual. So what this implies is that there's a sort of, at this population level, there's a trade-off between what individual cells know about their environment what the population, how much control you have over the population. So this is the amount of information individual cells have. You can see it drops precipitously as you add noise to these kind of models. So as you add more and more heterogeneity and make the cells more different from one another in the population. But what you can see here is that you get a huge increase in the amount of information that's available to control populations. So the idea here is that these systems may not have evolved to control individual cells, to tell that cell to die, but rather just to tell about 10% of them to die. Another cool thing that I'll leave you with, hopefully I can indulge you for another 5 minutes or 2 minutes, is that this gradual change in the number of cells that die may have evolved to allow noise to compensate for noise. So what I told you originally is that these signals are being sent not by the experimentalist, but by other cells. They're the senders, right? And cells have some noise, right? And so let's say, imagine we're in that bone compartment, and the osteocytes are trying to tell these cells to die. But the problem is that there's a little bit of fluctuation in the amount of signal they're sending. There's been a break, but just because of fluctuations in numbers and inherent randomness in biochemical processes, there's a little bit of fluctuation in that signal they're sending. Imagine that the osteoclasts, those big cells that kill the bone and eat the bone, imagine if they're really good at detecting small fluctuations in signal. So there's a very tight control over the population. What you can see here is that this small fluctuation ends up being magnified into a huge fluctuation in terms of the number of cells that survive, right? So I'll go from having 20% of my osteoclasts surviving to 80% of them surviving, just with this little fluctuation due to some biochemical randomness in the amount of signal that those cells are producing. I mean, they have to make it. They have to synthesize it. And that could be a random process. Or it is certainly subject at least to some amount of fluctuation. So you can see here that if cells are really, really good at detecting information in their environment, there's going to be a lot of fluctuation in their response at the population levels. But if you have this black curve where the individual cells now know less about their environment, so individual cells actually are noisier. They're getting worse at telling how much signal there is. But now you can see that same fluctuation in the signal corresponds to a much smaller fluctuation in the population level response. So because the noise controls the steepness of this curve, the gain of the curve, if you will, the way in which fluctuations in the input here are translated into fluctuations in the output becomes less and less. And actually, what you tend to find, both with responses to signal and responses to drugs, things like cell death or other discrete cellular events occur over orders of magnitude differences in the input. So there's a huge, gradual, long, very, very, very shallow curve. And it's probably because these cells have actually evolved to minimize the extent to which fluctuations in signal ultimately impact the population level response. So with that, I'm going to just have to skip all this stuff. You can see here's a cell that's chasing a bacterium. It's going to eat it, but we don't have time for that. Oh, and you can see this cell really wants to get that. Look at it. It's like, I want that. So we actually did some analysis from an information theoretic perspective and showed that when you've got individual cells that are actually important for a response, like this individual neutrophil has to eat this bacterium, it's going to get, there it goes. When you have individual cells that are responsible for a certain particular physiological response, there's way more information present in these systems. But I don't have time to talk about that. So the intro was a little bit longer than I expected, so I'll just finish with the basic take-home message. This is the perspective on cellular individuality that we've come to over the past several years working on this kind of problem. The idea is that we can think of an abstract gene expression space, and different cell types are going to occupy different regions of that gene expression space. This is a two-dimensional space here. And the idea is that there's two things going on here. One is that you have some signal that's being presented not just to cell type 1, but also to cell type 2. And that the difference in gene expression patterns in this highly interconnected complex signaling network results in different overall responses for these two different cell types. This is going to have some amount of proliferation. This is going to have some amount of apoptosis. But not only that, these envelopes of gene expression have evolved to have a very, very wide and heterogeneous distribution. So you've got a lot of heterogeneity here. And the idea is that that's what produces these probability distributions over responses. So it's not that there's a deterministic relationship between signal and response where every cell does the same thing, but rather noise in gene expression has actually evolved to provide you with the right shape of these distributions given the physiological context. So what we're working on now is trying to understand how this heterogeneity might be generated and regulated in cells. How this, and when I say model, what I mean is experimentally and computationally, can we actually build models that are a little bit more physiologically reasonable regarding this crosstalk and a little bit more biochemically reasonable and sort of rationalize how different cell types respond to the same environment as in that bone remodeling case. And one of the other interesting things we're really fascinated by is what might this mean for the evolution of multicellularity in metazoans. So I would guess that if I'm going to take a step back, I would argue that this sort of specific regions that these different cell types occupy in this gene expression space, and also the shape and size of these sort of envelopes, that heterogeneity, those things are crucial for implementing multicellularity the way that we have it. At least that's my hypothesis. And so the question is, do we find this in all metazoans? Is this present across all of these different clades? Or is it actually not? Is it specific to a subset? Have there been multiple solutions to this same problem in evolution? And one thing I'll just leave you with is that recently people have started doing the kind of experiments that I'm talking about, or at least I might be talking about, especially experiments on gene expression in a variety of organisms. So this is Hydra. It's a cnidarian. It's very, very different from us. You can see that's it. It doesn't talk. It doesn't give talks. It doesn't have a head. It's radially symmetric. It's also immortal, which is pretty darn cool. It lives in freshwater. It's one of the coolest organisms in the universe. If you don't know anything about it, you should totally read about it. But the idea is that it's got a bunch of different cell types, and it's got a huge genome, 17,000 genes. We have 20,000. So we have all kinds of fingers and stuff, and we eat ham sandwiches. But we only have 3,000 more genes than these guys do, right? So we seem much more complicated. But from a genetic standpoint, these guys are pretty similar. Obviously have a much less complex sort of body plan organization. And what people have started to be able to do is actually quantify those envelopes of gene expression space. So this is a 2D representation of gene expression space. And you can see it's actually not that different from what I drew before. And that's not a coincidence. I drew the picture I drew because of the availability now of gene expression data. Each point in this is a single cell. So this is single cell transcriptomic data. And we're starting to actually try to understand this data in the framework that I just showed you. And with that, I'd just like to thank the people who did the work. Everything I showed you is largely the work of two grad students in my lab from the University of Kansas, Michael Rowland and Ryan Suderman. Michael did the crosstalk work and Ryan did the information theory work. We also collaborated closely with Peter Sorger's group at Harvard Med School on the information theory work, and particularly with John Bachman, who was a grad student with Peter at the time. And also, I'd like to thank Walter for his sort of intellectual guidance in all of this. And with that, I don't know if we take questions, but I'd just like to thank you for listening to me.